From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, October 28, 2008. The NAACP challenges Virginia's Election Day procedures, alleging the state hasn't done enough to accommodate massive voter turnout. Next week's election could determine the country's approach to trade. We'll hear about the future of the Colombia Free Trade Agreement. And new federal statistics indicate hate crimes against individuals based on their sexual orientation is up nearly 6%. I'm Aura Bogado. Stay tuned for that and more after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Congo's army is abandoning a town in the eastern province of North Kivu. Tens of thousands of civilians have already fled the area. Heavily armed Tutsi rebels are advancing rapidly on the city just north of Goma. UN peacekeepers left the region and were unable to evacuate some 50 foreign aid workers. The town had provided shelter for refugees displaced by nearly 2 years of fighting in the tin mining region. Opening arguments began today in federal court in San Francisco in a trial to determine if Chevron was responsible for a deadly clash between Nigerian forces and activists occupying an oil platform. From KPFA in Berkeley, Max Pringle reports.
The trial will determine whether the San Ramon-based oil giant is responsible for two deaths and several injuries among people who shut down the Parabay oil platform in 1998 for 3 days before Nigerian armed forces flew in on a Chevron contractor's helicopter to respond. Larry Bowoto, one of the Parabay platform protesters injured in the incident, brought the case. Both sides agree that Bowoto and other members of the local activist group Concerned Ilaje Citizens were on a Chevron oil platform on the Niger Delta for 3 days. The accounts differ significantly from there. Lawsuit supporters say 10 years ago, Chevron flew in Nigerian forces who then used deadly force against unarmed protesters. Omaile Shaware is a Nigerian environmentalist.
They invaded a platform where peaceful protesters had been demanding for jobs and clean water and for Chevron to clean up their acts in their region, and they were shot at. One was killed right there on the spot, and several of them were injured, and the rest of them were arrested and detained and tortured for a prolonged period of time with the active connivance and support of Chevron, actually funding by Chevron.
Chevron released a statement saying that protesters threatened to harm about 100 workers and burn down the platform if their demands for jobs and money weren't met. The company said shots were fired when some of the protesters attacked Nigerian forces attempting to free the captives. The suit seeks damages for the injuries and deaths associated with the incident and for jobs and other benefits for people living in the Niger region. Chevron said it maintains the right to protect its employees from harm and will prove it acted responsibly in court. The trial is set to conclude in early December. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Max Pringle.
An alarming report on food stamp usage released today says that one-third of people living in poverty in American cities are missing out on food stamp benefits. Catherine Jarmul has more.
According to a new report on Americans' use of food stamps, one in three families struggling in urban households are not utilizing food stamp benefits. The report was issued today by a nonprofit group called Food Research and Action Center, or FRAC. They say that urban areas are underserved by the current food stamp program and methods of outreach. According to the report, food insecurity and poverty are more highly concentrated in cities, but many of those who are eligible to receive federal help don't due to cultural and language barriers, worries about stigma, or lack of enrollment information. An alarming trend in the data shows that some of the highest percentages of people who are eligible for food stamps but don't receive them live in southwestern cities. San Diego, Denver, Las Vegas, and Houston are among some of the lowest rated, each falling below 55% involvement. The food stamp program, recently renamed the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, was reauthorized and given more federal dollars in the recent Farm Bill. FRAC estimates low-income urban Americans are losing almost $30.4 billion federal dollars for food aid that could help more than 26 million people per year. To help increase participation, FRAC recommends that the federal program allow people to register online or over the phone. Also, more education and outreach should be done with the communities at places where people shop, work, and go to school, and in several languages. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Catherine Jarmel in Washington, D.C.
The military has opened the war crimes trial of an alleged al-Qaeda member. It's the second time around for six of the jurors, including the foreman, who deliberated the sentence of another military commission's convict, Australian David Hicks. And in another of the military trials, a judge has granted defense counsel access to secret cell blocks at Guantanamo Bay. Peter Granitz reports from Capitol Hill.
Osama bin Laden's accused communications director, Ali Hamza al-Balhoul, isn't known for keeping quiet, but that's exactly what he did in court today. Al-Balhoul did not speak yesterday or today because he doesn't want a military attorney. And in a move of solidarity, his military-appointed lawyer, Major David Frocht, joined his client's protest. In a separate trial, a military judge has granted defense counsel access to Camp 7 at the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. Attorneys for Ramzi bin al-Shib requested an inspection of confinement as part of an investigation into their client's mental health. The government accuses bin al-Shib of serving as an intermediary between al-Qaeda leadership in Afghanistan and the 9/11 hijackers. He was captured by United States forces more than 5 years ago. Bin al-Shib requested that he represent himself, and his attorneys contend that shows signs of mental illness. Bin al-Shib has been given psychotropic drugs used to suppress schizophrenia. Judge Ralph Coleman granted the to-be-scheduled visit against the government's wishes. Bin al-Shib has been held at the mysterious Camp 7, where 16 high-value detainees have been held and interrogated by the CIA. Military officials first acknowledged the existence of Camp 7 earlier this year. It is unclear what role, if any, the CIA still has at Camp 7. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Peter Granitz in Washington.
From WMNF Community Radio in Tampa for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
A lawsuit is challenging the state of Virginia's Election Day procedures. The lawsuit claims people could lose their right to vote because the state inadequately prepared to accommodate massive turnout come Tuesday. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell has the story.
The NAACP and the Advancement Project say Virginia's voting system will result in disenfranchising voters.
We think that in some places it's going to be a meltdown.
That was Judith Brown Dianis, co-director of the Advancement Project. The suit says Virginia is not prepared to handle high voter turnout, that not enough voting machines and poll workers will be provided in some polling places around the state.
When you have these kinds of disparities, what it means is that you have long lines, and long lines lead to people losing their right to vote because they cannot stand in line.
Democratic Governor Tim Kaine said on local WTOP radio Tuesday morning that Virginia is prepared and compliant.
Every precinct meets the standard, and frankly, many jurisdictions have not only the minimum, but 2 to 3 times the equipment they need.
Virginia is not used to being a battleground state. It has consistently voted Republican since 1964. But this year, the state has registered 500,000 new voters and reports that turnout is expected to break records, surpassing 80%. Governor Kaine says the state has responded, that the state has nearly doubled the number of voting machines since the 2004 election.
I want to make very clear that my state board of elections is very focused on making sure everybody votes.
But the suit points to a report by the Advancement Project earlier this year that analyzed election board records. The records reveal that not all polling sites will receive the same attention. Again, Judith Brown Dianis.
We found that there were disparities with regard to race and the allocation of machines. And so you could be in the more heavily minority your precinct is, the fewer machines that you would have.
For example, in some precincts in Virginia Beach, some polling places will have one voting machine per 120 voters. But at other precincts within the same town, one voting machine must accommodate 4 times as many people, one for every 450 voters. That same sort of ratio plays out with poll workers, one poll worker for every 90 voters in some precincts, in neighboring precincts, one poll worker for every 400 voters. Similar scenarios are documented in the city of Norfolk and Richmond. Virginia does not have the option of early voting, which can often ease congestion on Election Day. The suit is asking the court to direct the state of Virginia to do 3 things. First, supply more voting machines to less resourced precincts, offer a paper ballot to voters waiting in line for more than 45 minutes, and keep the polls open 2 hours longer on Election Day. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The Republican National Committee has sent non-Republican voters in Northern California a letter identifying them as Republicans. The letters include a registration card with a false voter ID number. Voting rights advocates say the letters are part of a voter caging campaign and an attempt to undermine non-Republican voters in next week's election. FSRN's Christina Honestad has the story.
Peggy McLeod has voted Democrat all her life. In past years, she campaigned for Bill Clinton and California's Congressmember Mike Thompson. And she served in local office as a Lake County Planning Commissioner. So when McLeod recently received a letter from the Republican Party indicating that she was a Republican, she contacted the Lake County's Registrar's Office about it.
What caught my eye was it said that I was a registered Republican. And it said in it, I have sent you a copy of your RNC file card for confirmation. And there was no way that they would have had a Republican National Committee file card for me. That caught my eye on the first page. Back to the envelope when it said, do not forward, that also caught my eye. Why would they not want this to be forwarded?
It says John McCain right on the envelope.
Mm-hmm. And on the back of it, it says the Republican National Committee, Voter Identification Division. It has this address in Washington, D.C.
The RNC, Republican National Committee, did not respond to numerous requests for an interview. Although the letters referred to a Voter Identification Division, RNC personnel said they had no such department. Voting rights advocates say the letter is the first step of voter caging, a voter suppression tactic. Janie Shepard is an attorney in Mendocino County and a voting rights advocate. She's worked the polls for over a decade.
Let's say you're a Republican and you don't want Democrats to vote. You sent out official-looking notices. The envelope on the outside will say, do not forward. So if it gets returned, the Republicans will go to the polls. They'll have challengers there who will challenge that person's right to vote. And unless the person can prove that they live where they are actually registered to vote, they will end up having to vote provisionally, which is a whole lot of paperwork. And it's a matter of record that 50% of provisional votes are not counted.
The letter also includes an RNC voter registration card with a voter identification number. Lake County Registrar Diane Fidley says that number did not match McLeod's real voter ID number.
There were ID numbers in the letter, but I have no idea what the ID numbers stand for because they have nothing to do with the registration here in Lake County.
What has your sense been of the people who have called? Have they been confused? Are they concerned?
They're concerned about their political affiliation and where that information came from, as well as what those ID numbers meant to this office or to them.
And nobody seems to quite know.
No.
Fidley says she received a handful of calls from voters who received the same mailer. Non-Republican voters in Napa County, California, have also received mailers from the Republican National Committee, according to the Weekly Calistogan. And the voting advocacy group Black Box Voting reports voters in Florida have also received mailers from the RNC. Meanwhile, McLeod says she wants to know where the Republican Party got her information. Chair of the Lake County Republican Central Committee says he was unaware of the letter from the RNC. Shepard says the mailers are part of a larger voter suppression effort.
Caging is really only just a part of a wider voter suppression movement in this country. And I just have to say this, it's all driven by Republicans who are using various ways to suppress the Democratic vote. They're not interested in suppressing their own vote.
Other voting caging tactics have occurred in Ohio, where elections officials have sent mailers to registered voters, and in Michigan, where Republicans were trying to use foreclosure to reject voters at the polls. Election protection watchdogs say tactics like these are attempts at curbing American democracy. Again, Shepard.
It's pretty horrifying to think that in a democracy, there are people who don't want your vote to be counted. I mean, you kind of think of this as happening in some dictatorship in Latin America or in one of the Russian satellite countries. But no, it's happening right here in this country.
I'm Christina Onnested reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Curious about what this letter from the RNC looks like? Go to our website, www.fsrn.org, where we've posted a copy of the letter sent to some California residents. The FBI announced charges against two white supremacists yesterday, including illegal possession of a firearm and making threats against a presidential candidate. The two men were allegedly plotting a killing spree, including an attack on a mostly black school and the assassination of Barack Obama. Although the plot was not highly developed, it may reveal some deep-seated racist emotion some people harbor throughout the nation. Meanwhile, according to federal statistics, hate crimes are down overall in the United States, although incidents against Latinos rose for the fourth year in a row, and crimes against individuals based on sexual orientation also increased. Deborah Lauder is the National Civil Rights Director at the American Defamation League. She says the rise in white supremacist groups may have more to do with the anti-immigrant movement, not just the election.
We saw a growth in the white extremist movement over the past year, but we really have pegged it more to the contentious debate over immigration in this country than these candidates' campaigns over the last few months. So in terms of actual numbers of hate crimes, no, we have not documented an upsurge.
A man in Ohio hung an Obama effigy from a noose in a tree, and he very proudly claims that he's racist and he certainly doesn't want a black man as president. What kind of effect does this have on residents, not just there in Ohio, but around the nation?
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes all of us in this country who are of goodwill, and that's clearly the majority, it makes our skin crawl. I mean, it harkens back to a time in this country where racism was, if not condoned, that certainly it wasn't fought as we do today. So when people see others who are racist express their hate in such a graphic way, I think it makes people react in various forms. Some of them react in anger. Some react in fear, particularly in the African-American community, for whom that effigy is such a powerful and haunting image. And others react, I think, with dismay that, you know, we thought we had gotten to another place and that maybe we're not there. So, you know, it does serve as a reminder that people of goodwill have to stand up to it and fight the hate constantly, because otherwise it'll prevail.
Let's talk about these new hate crime statistics. The headline reads that hate crimes are down overall, but that's not true in terms of sexual orientation, correct?
That's correct. And I would have to point out, the statistics from the FBI are down very slightly. The 2007 statistics that are reported are 7,624. And that's really just a slight decrease from the 7,722 before. So in a way, it's good news. Fine, there's a slight decrease. But on the other hand, it's bad news. This is way too many. And particularly, the number of hate crimes directed at gay men and lesbians increased almost 6%, and that is something that should concern all of us. The other trend we saw in this report is, even though the numbers were somewhat slight increase, we are now seeing a trend in the number of hate crimes against the Hispanic community. So it's the fourth year in a row that those numbers have been creeping up, and again, something that all of us should be concerned about.
How do you think the anti-immigrant and militia movements might be contributing to that?
The Anti-Defamation League, you know, released a report showing that the extremist rhetoric that had come out of both the Minutemen and other white extremist organizations was, in fact, seeping into mainstream rhetoric. And, you know, at the ADL, we have always told people that hate rhetoric can result in hate violence. And we believe that the atmospherics in this country over the divisive debate has, in fact, resulted in this kind of increase in hate crime against Hispanics.
Deborah Lauder is the National Civil Rights Director at the American Defamation League. You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. Make sure to tune in on Election Day when Washington editor Leanne Caldwell and I will be broadcasting from Chicago. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi blocked a vote on the Colombia Free Trade Agreement last spring, but it's not over yet. It's one of the three free trade deals left on Bush's agenda, and he, along with John McCain, are committed to passing it. Tanya Snyder reports.
Free trade is controversial enough. Free trade with Colombia is a tinderbox. The Colombian Congress approved the trade agreement last year. President George Bush made it a top priority to get it passed in the U.S. Congress, but it wouldn't budge. The Colombia Agreement is built on the same framework as the North American Free Trade Agreement between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. James Plaser says that's reason enough for his group, Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, to oppose it.
What we've seen is a race to the bottom so far, and with these NAFTA-type WTO sorts of trade policies that really put corporate interests ahead of working people and family farmers.
Mexico is a dream trade partner compared to Colombia. Colombia has been embroiled in a brutal civil war for more than 40 years. Dozens of high-level political figures are under investigation for ties to drug traffickers and illegal armed groups. The country's best-known export is cocaine, and bilateral trade in that commodity is alive and well, according to numbers from a recent White House report. Ben Beachy of the solidarity group Witness for Peace says Colombian farmers who can't compete with an influx of cheap U.S. grains often turn to more lucrative crops, like coca.
We've now spent more than $5 billion in through Plan Colombia with the sole purpose of eradicating coca. So it's more than a little ironic that we're now giving an extra incentive to grow it.
Freddy Caicedo is an economist and human rights organizer from Colombia. He agrees that small businesses wouldn't be able to compete with the production capacity of U.S. companies. It's just one on a long list of complaints he has about the trade agreement, including its provisions on intellectual property rights.
We're concerned that it leaves open the possibility that seeds, plants, animals, even smells, all the knowledge that our people can produce, can be patented and kept in the hands of corporations so that they can make money off of them.
In the last presidential debate, Republican John McCain slammed Barack Obama for not supporting the Colombia Free Trade Agreement.
Free trade with Colombia is something that's a no-brainer.
Obama sided with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who took the trade deal off the table last spring. He said the human rights violations in Colombia were too severe to ignore.
The history in Colombia right now is that labor leaders have been targeted for assassination on a fairly consistent basis, and there have not been prosecutions.
Obama's statement echoed the concerns voiced by Democrats on Capitol Hill. In general, their opposition isn't based on the trade model itself, but on the human rights problems and corruption that's specific to Colombia. Colombian President Álvaro Uribe came to Washington last month to make the case that a trade deal with Colombia would help solve those problems.
Free trade agreement for us is the possibility to give certainty to investors for them to come to Colombia. And the more the investors come to Colombia, the less difficult for us to defeat terrorism.
If Obama is elected president, Uribe will find a much less sympathetic ear in the Oval Office than he's been used to. Even McCain would face an uphill battle getting the new Congress to consider the free trade deal. Fast-track legislation, which gives Congress 90 days to debate a trade deal, was supposed to put an end to lengthy delays. But Pelosi's actions stopped the clock. Human rights observers like Lena Saunders of Witness for Peace hope it stays stopped. She says she has seen the face of free trade in Colombia, and it isn't pretty.
Well, Colombia is hoping for the FTA to be passed. And in preparations for that, they've been working on expanding the port in Buenaventura. Buenaventura port is the largest port in the Pacific coast. And to be able to expand it to allow for this trade, there's been a lot of violence.
Saunders says military and paramilitary forces have used violence to drive people off their land where they want to expand the port. Most of the displaced are people of African descent. Saunders and other human rights workers fear that free trade could lead to more violence. For FSRN, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
The U.S. presidential election is capturing attention the world over, including in South America. Case in point, no less than 6 candidates in this month's various municipal elections in Brazil changed their names to Barack Obama, a nod to someone that many Brazilians, especially those of African descent, look up to. South American headlines are littered with news about next week's election, so we sent our Chile correspondent, Jorge Garretón, to the streets of Santiago to get a slice of what people there think of next week's election.
Hi, my name is Pilar. I think the great news about these elections in the USA has definitely been Obama. I think Obama has made all the change, renovation, input to a new kind of election, to a new kind of political future. I thought it was never going to happen. And there we are, a black man as president of the USA. Amazing.
Hi, I'm Hernan Ortega. I work for a transport company. I'm surprised that the black man has been able to climb that high, in particular because of the racial problem we have seen, or I have personally perceived in the U.S. I do not think he'll win the election because one way or the other he will not make it to the White House.
Hi, I'm Lydia Gazes. I'm a lawyer. I keep thinking back that whether the U.S. as a society, that whole population in the middle of the country, whether it's really ready to elect and to have a black president. If one thinks about the level of violence, verbal violence, I would really be thinking whether he would really be able to survive in that post if he's elected.
Hello, my name is Ricardo San Martin Molinay. I work in the Ministry of Public Works. I think Barack Obama is a great person. I don't know him personally, but in interviews and debates with McCain, he has appeared in good standing. The only thing that I have missed from him is a wider view of Latin America, because up until now, we have not seen specifics.
Hi, my name is Sylvia. I'm a non-believer in politics. This is why I think no matter who is elected, not too many changes can occur in their general policy towards the rest of the world.
Hi, my name is Miriam Labrim. Above all, I find it rewarding that a black man is able to compete for the U.S. presidency in such a large and conservative country.
Well, first of all, hi, my name is Paolo. I think there will be some changes, and I'm certain about it, because there's always changes. It will be a very controversial kind of change. That's what I believe. I think something will happen that may change the U.S. government, and I would say, in other words, forever.
FSRN's Jorge Garretón recorded these voices in Santiago, Chile. And that will do it for today's newscast. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback. Just drop us an email to comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Jess Burns. And our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Puck Lowe, Rose Katabchi, and Oscar Hernandez. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. And that will do it for today's newscast. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback. Just drop us an email to comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Jess Burns. And our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Puck Lowe, Rose Katabchi, and Oscar Hernandez. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.